You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
Let's do it later.
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy?
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th, hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
Welcome back to Speak for Yourself. Sad news in the NFL today. Legendary Dolphins coach Don Shula passed away at the age of 90. The Dolphins issued a statement saying Shula died peacefully at his home. Shula is still the NFL's all-time winningest coach and won two Super Bowls, including the 1972 perfect season. All right, we're joined now by Brian Cox, who was drafted by Don Shula in 1991, played for him from 91 until 1995. Brian, how much did Don Shula mean to your career?
Well, I woke up this morning to a saddened phone call. Don Shula is responsible for my career, I would say, in its totality, because the man taught me how to love. He taught me trust. He taught me responsibility. He taught me selflessness, where, you know, you would do things for him that you wouldn't do for some other coaches. I mean, I really love the man. I'm gonna miss him. I'm sad, but you know, when I think about it, I feel even sadder because the last time I saw him was Super Bowl 50 in San Francisco, and he rolled up in his wheelchair and he gave me the finger and he said, "I taught him everything he knows." And that was the last time I'd ever seen him, and that makes me sad. Mm. That makes me really sad.
Brian, you were a wild and crazy guy when you entered the NFL. Playing for the most legendary coach at that time. How did Don Shula deal with that wild and crazy Brian Cox?
Well, he let me go a little bit, but he reeled me in. And when, you know, he'd call you to the office, you knew you had some problems going on. And he'd get me in his office and he'd lay into me. But what I remember most about those times when he would have to get after me is at the end of those conversations, he'd say, "I love you. Let's go out there and let's get the team ready this week and let's go get a win." So he was real big on discipline and discipline his players. But at the end of it, it was always, "I love you and let's go to work."
Just for perspective, rest in peace, obviously, Don Shula. He coached against George Halas and Bill Belichick. Literally, that's the first coach in the NFL in 1920 and a coach who is still active today and had a winning percentage against both of those coaches. Amazing. Rest in peace. That said, man, you played for some tremendous coaches, Belichick, Parcells, and Shula. Who had the most impact on Brian Cox?
All of them had their impact. I think Shula taught me how to be a man coming into this league, taught me how to be a pro, taught me respect. And like I said, the selfishness that he taught on the team. When you go to Parcells, that's the guy that I still talk to mostly today, that I'm closest to, has taught me so much about life and about manhood. He's been the biggest father figure. And Bill Belichick, I don't know off the field. I just know him as a great coach. You don't compare any of them, because how do you define greatness? That's three Hall of Fame coaches I played for. The only guy that I know played for more than three Hall of Fame coaches would be Eric Green, and he played for Chuck Noll, Bill Cowell, Belichick, and Parcells and Shula. Mm. So he played for four Hall of Famers. Mm. But, you know, how do you define greatness? They were all great.
Now, can you group them together in terms of their similarities? How were they the same?
Well, Belichick and Parcells were the same. They teach and coach out of fear. If you don't do your job, they're going to get rid of you. They're going to let you know it. and they go with everybody. That may be the rift between Brady and Belichick because they call everybody out. Shula was different. Shula taught out of love and just leadership, and he was one of those old school coaches that could get the most out of players by letting each guy be an individual person. But he was just that guy that he ended up getting fired after 33 seasons as a head coach, 31 of which had winning record. He got fired at the end of his career because he was too loyal and would not fire any of his assistants. Loyalty was high on his list, and I just thank God that I had the opportunity and blessed enough that I had the opportunity to meet him, play for him, and get to know him a little bit off of the field.
All right, Brian, Shula, Parcells, Belichick, if you had to take one guy on a fishing trip, who you taking?
Parcells, for sure. And that's no disrespect to Belichick or Shula, but I just talk to Parcells the most right now. He's like a father figure to me. I don't make one important decision without calling him. Now, Coach Shula and I had that kind of relationship. When we saw each other, he'd open a restaurant in California when I was leaving out there. He'd call and invite me and my wife to come out to the opening. We'd go to restaurants and we'd see each other around. But I just wasn't around him enough towards the end, whereas with Parcells, we talk on the phone. I probably talk to him at least once a month, maybe 12, 16, 20 times a year, where we talk about different things. So he'd be the guy that I'd take on the fishing trip probably. And I don't know Bill Belichick off the field outside of football.
Would you consult with Parcells about the color of your shirt next time you're on this show? Perhaps some advice
don't
there.
Do it.
I wore that shirt too.
Jason, you too big to have this kind of swag.
Oh! That's true. Good point. All right, we gotta go. Uncle Jimmy's around the corner. We're gonna talk about Andy Dalton's approval rating. Speak for yourself from the crib. More after this.
Shot fired.
That's my dog.
Welcome back to Speak for Yourself from the crib. Jason Whitlock, Marcellus Wiley on a Tuesday afternoon. All right, we have one of the most anticipated interviews in the show's history. Someone who mentored and tutored Marcellus Wiley, that's probably not his greatest accomplishment. I think 200 sacks, the Hall of Fame for Super Bowl appearances, two-time Defensive Player of the Year in the NFL. Bruce, we will start there. You played three seasons with Marcellus Wiley. What's your fondest memory of tutoring Marcellus?
Man, every day was an experience. This young brother was such a joy to be around. After I was this seasoned veteran and trying to pass on some of this knowledge to Marcellus so he could have the opportunity to blossom, become that player he wanted to become in the National Football League. But he was just, he was like a sponge. He wanted to learn. He wanted to engage. He wanted to find out the secrets and the nuances of the art of playing the defensive end position and rushing the quarterback. So it was my honor and my pleasure to have that opportunity to spend that time with him.
You know, listening to you with that description, besides talent, work ethic, desire, drive, what separated Marcellus's level of success from yours besides those issues?
Well, he graduated from Columbia. And but look, man, he was just this ball of energy. And this personality that went along with all of this energy that he had inside of him, and from the way he talked, the way he carried himself, the way he engaged with other individuals, particularly his teammates, he was always such a joy to be around and come to work that next day. And if you spent any time in our locker room, it was a comedy show every single day between the likes of Thurman Thomas and Jim Kelly and Daryl Talley. And then you add Marcellus to the big mix and Ted Washington and so many others. It was such a joy to go to work in the morning because you knew that it wasn't like going to work. You were going to be with your brothers and continuing to grow that bond that would only transfer and become stronger as you entered out into that field to go to war. So, man, it was just a fun and exciting time, even at that stage when Marcellus came and they actually drafted him to take my job. You know, most people didn't know that. But, you know, me being and understanding that everything has a shelf life and one day it would have been my time to give it up and pass that torch on. But instead of looking at, I call him my son, as a threat, I said, it's time for me to pass this knowledge on so this man can have a productive life and make all the money he possibly can and make a name for himself. So that's what this was all about.
Man, love it, man. Long story short, there's only one Bruce Smith, so he didn't have any concerns about passing on the knowledge. There was only going to be one, number 78, man. And you know how much I think of you on and off the field. I call you my football pops, man. You taught me so much. But being around you for those years and knowing how great you are, the best defensive lineman to ever live, you feel a bit underrated because you were in Buffalo rather than a large market city like New York?
Well, obviously, if I would have played in a bigger market, perhaps it might have been a different outcome and perception. But I think for the most part, people knew us for our dynamic offense. We were, particularly in the early 90s and the late 80s, we were the most prolific offensive unit at that time for about 4, 5, 6 years. We put points on the board like no other team in that period of time with that K-gun and no huddle offense with Jim Kelly at the helm and Thurman Thomas and Andre Reed and James Lofton and Steve Tasker, just to name a few of them. And Ted Machabrota, who was the offensive coordinator when we first got started, and obviously we had a excellent backup quarterback and park coach, Frank Wright. So we had a lot of guys that were not only great athletes, they were student of the games. But just to focus on, had I played in a different city, who knows? The story might not have turned out the way it did. But the one thing that I can say is that the evolution of my game existed because I wanted to become a student of the game. I wanted to be that versatile player that not only was dominant against the run, but was dominant against the pass while playing in that 3-4 defensive scheme, which, you know, Marcellus, it's the 3-4 defensive scheme is pretty much devised for the linebackers to make tackles. Not the defensive linemen. We keep the linebackers free. I know Ted used to hate, he'd have to eat up the double team so the inside linebackers could scrape and make the tackles. But once you perfect your craft and you understand the defensive schemes and you understand where that hole is open for that split second, so you can still, in the defensive framework, you can still have your gap responsibility, but you can penetrate and get in the backfield. And you know, that's where I think I stepped my game up and being able to be that student of the game and know when they line up in a certain formation, I knew what play was coming out. And I was able to exploit that and get into the backfield.
All right, we're going to run the K-gun offense. I'm going to shoot these at you quick. How much more would you have been celebrated if you guys had won one of those four Super Bowls?
Well, I think obviously it would have certainly made a huge difference. And I think the best chance we had was the first one against the New York Giants, and we lost by 1 point because of a missed field goal. But nevertheless, we still had our opportunities in that particular ball game to win that ball game. I think the coaching staff from the Giants did an excellent job of dropping nine people and only rushing two, and it caught us off guard, and we just didn't adjust to it very well.
Okay, there's an argument I have. It feels like on a weekly basis, and you know my answer, but all respect to the late, great Reggie White and Bruce Smith. Who's the greatest defensive end of all time? I'm waiting.
Come on. Come on. And this, again, this was in my football life story. I'm not boasting. I'm not bragging. I'm talking about film study. I'm talking about statistics. I'm talking about having to defeat the double team on a consistent basis. Reggie was in a class that most people, he was built differently. Reggie was a power rusher. He had the signature hump move. He was able to be put into a situation where he played on a defensive line with Sean Jones and Clyde Simmons, who both had over 100 sacks in their career. Played for the late, great Buddy Ryan, who was the architect of the Bear defense, which means you send more people than the offense can block. So nobody gets double teamed, and there's even a free blitzer that comes through. So having said that, Reggie Wright, dear friend, love him to death. Reggie and I had this conversation a number of times. He said, Bruce, if you had played in a 4-3 defense, no one would have ever touched you because you wouldn't have gotten double teamed to the extent that you did because you were in a 3-4. So that speaks for itself. A 3-4 versus a 4-3. That 3-4 defensive end is going to get double teamed consistently. A 4-3 defensive end has outside leverage, and he is not going to get double teamed as much.
Man, preach, brother, preach. I've been saying that. Look, Buffalo, we both played there. It doesn't always get a good rap. Describe your relationship with the city of Buffalo.
Oh, man, I love Buffalo. I love the people in Buffalo. I love the food. I love chicken. I love the chicken wings. I love chefs. And the weather kind of grows on you as well after a while. And particularly when you're winning, the weather warms up. It feels mighty good. And the fans are just so enthusiastic, passionate. And they have such a desire to support their sports. So that's what made us want to go out and play extremely hard and make them feel proud and so forth. So it was an incredible experience for me, and I try and get back as often as I possibly can. And I've got a lot of friends there that still live in Buffalo. I had a dear friend that passed away, Larry White, who was a police officer in Buffalo. But I've got a number of friends there, and Buffalo is very fond in my heart.
Bruce, you mentioned the A Football Life documentary on the NFL Network. I watched it. It was tremendous. In there, though, it mentioned, Steve Tasker mentioned, that you and Jim Kelly did not start off with the greatest relationship, and then I watched Jim Kelly talk about you as a brother now. You guys are very, very close. What happened early on, and then how did you guys become so close?
Well, I think we were two-star athletes, just young. He was the quarterback of the team, and I wasn't necessarily the quarterback on defense, but I was the first player picked in the draft. And I don't think it was anything that was tremendously contentious. I just think that in some cases, one might have taken an offense to something that was said here or that. Actually, I do remember one of the things that it was during practice. And Jim had made a statement off of the field or something. And I said, OK, I'm just going to show Jim I can have my way during practice when we start live drills and so forth. So I beat the left tackle around the corner and was kind of toying with him a little bit. And I went behind Jim and knocked the ball out of his hands, which wasn't the smartest thing to do because I could have injured our star quarterback. And then we would have been obviously in a bad situation for the season or until he came back. And we got into a little confrontation. But I think he got the point that let's keep this civil, and we'll be able to have a workable relationship. But we really started bonding together when Jim would have, after home games, he would have get together at his house in the basement. He would invite the whole team and their family over. We would go down, and man, we'd be down there too. 2-3 o'clock in the morning, sometimes shooting pool, watching other football games, and just having a great time. And his mother would be upstairs. And I found out that his mother had emphysema, which my father was suffering from at the time. So I would start going up stairs and talking with Mrs. Kelly. And I did this repeatedly, game after home game after home game after home game. And I just felt this connection with my father being here in Norfolk, Virginia, and in sitting there talking to her and understanding how she was ailing and couldn't breathe and had to walk around with the oxygen tank and so forth. And our relationship just seemed to blossom almost to the extent that his mother started calling me son as well. And that's how she thought of me. And that's how we bonded. And Jim, our relationship just kind of springboarded off of that. I love that man to death. He's been through an awful lot with the loss of his son, due to Krabbe's disease. He lost his father a number of years ago, and now him and his battle with cancer. But God bless him and his family, man. We think about him, and we cherish the relationship we have each and every day.
Bruce, I don't want to rush you, but we're running out of time, and I can't let you go without asking about one other thing from that A Football Life documentary. It mentioned... you were bullied as a kid. And I wanted to know a little details on that and what impact it had on your life.
Man, that's a great question. I'm glad you brought that up. But it taught me how to treat people and how not to treat people. It taught me a lot of lessons in life, man, because there were so many times that I came home and I just didn't know where to turn. I would cry sometimes. I would walk around depressed, and it was just a low point in my life, and trying to understand why this was happening to me. But I think the fact that sports came into my life, it started giving me that. Outlook and taking that timid little kid and making me more and more of a strong teenager and a young man, and giving me the discipline and things that were necessary to help me survive through the struggles of life. So it really was an important time in my life, and it would. Who knows? It probably was necessary for me to go through those things, because now I look upon people as I want to treat people. I want to treat people the way that I want to be treated. And that's the way I look at it. It was a critical time in my young childhood.
Bruce, we want to thank you for coming on the show. You don't know this, but you're mentioned virtually every day off air on the show. Pray.
That's my dog.
Pray for what?
Yes.
LeVar brings you up virtually every day.
L.A.
You and Marty Schottenheimer. Thank you so much for the time. Appreciate it.
Thanks.
All right, LeVar Arrington's just around the corner.
It, Pop.
Speak for yourself.
LA.
From the crib presented by Hyundai. Pray. Pray for why?
Pray
for yourself.
Why?
Go after this. All right. That's my dog. Welcome back to Speak for Yourself from the crib. Jason Whitlock, Marcellus Wiley. Speak for Yourself presented to you by Hyundai. All right, let's roll up to Woodland Hills, California, just outside of L.A., and pull up at Terrell Davis's crib, John Elway's best friend, Hall of Famer, Super Bowl champion, twice over. Terrell, get us rolling here. We're going to talk some Andy Dalton, Dak Prescott. Is Andy Dalton any sort of a threat to Dak Prescott in Dallas?
First of all, I'm mad at you guys with that graphic. Got me on the couch looking like I'm just lazy and soft. I'm upset with that graphic, but I'll get past that. And I'll answer your question here. Is he a threat to Dak Prescott? The answer is no, he's not a threat to Dak. But I think if you're the Cowboys, you're looking at a guy who's a seasoned veteran, who's played, you know, 8 or 9 years in the league. He's a proven starter in this league. And I think you need that for some depth. You need that for insurance purposes. You don't know what's going to happen with this contract. You know, Dak might not report to camp on time. So it makes sense to me to bring him in to have some depth at that position in case you need to go a few games without your starting quarterback. But as far as thinking that Andy Dalton is somehow going to, you know, beat out Dak Prescott, I don't see it. I know that over the years, Andy had some, he had some really good years, you know, about 3 or 4 years ago. But I think we've seen his ceiling, and he's just, to me, an insurance purpose for the Dallas Cowboys. And I would be shocked if he beats Dak Prescott out in Dallas going into the 2020 season.
Oh, he's a threat, all right. But he's more of an idle threat, not an active threat. The difference being, like, he's not an active shooter, Remy on the Roof and Higher Learning. He's the old man in the scary movies. You ever go and watch the scary movie in the beginning, the old man sitting on the porch just looking like, okay, mess around if you want to, see what's going to happen. And look, we saw last year with Dak Prescott had 5 games last year with more interceptions or didn't throw a touchdown. Mess around and have those games consecutively in a row. Oh, you know who's the most popular guy on a struggling team? The backup, quarterback, so be careful, Dak.
Yeah, I think he's a bit of a threat too, Terrell, for the reason of if Dak misses the entire offseason and Andy Dalton gets to get established with the head coach, and if for some reason Andy Dalton ever gets on the field via injury because Dak sat out and he wins a game, that's going to plant a seed. Oh, we can win games with Andy Dalton. And if for some reason Dak's out and he misses 2 or 3 games and Andy Dalton goes 2 or 3 and 0 in that stretch, then he's a real threat. But let's keep it moving. Let's move to Antonio Brown, the former Raider, Pittsburgh Steeler. Set out almost all of the 2019 season. He's put out a picture over Instagram of himself playing in a Baltimore Ravens uniform. But I'm starting to have some real doubts if Antonio Brown's going to play at all this season. TD, do you think Antonio Brown remains out of football this season?
Wow. This is a tough one for me. Because I know that, and we talk about it, you know, sometimes questionable character, talent will outweigh that. And if you're a team that needs a wide receiver of Antonio Brown's ability and skills, you might be desperate enough to say, I'm going to take a chance on him, especially if I can get a contract that keeps him at bay. That the first time he says something or does something, he's out of there. He's only playing for a bunch of incentives. You got enough teams who are starving who might want that explosive player in their locker room. But obviously all the legal stuff has to be taken care of. The commissioner has to be able to bless him to get him back into football. But if all those things happen, I would not be shocked to see Antonio Brown back in the NFL in 2020. Because some desperate team is going to go get this back.
Man, I'm pretty much sold. It's a wrap for Antonio Brown, and it's unfortunate. And it's not even by the team-by-team breakdown. It's not even that. It's the umbrella of the NFL that has not even ruled yet on his suspension. And let's not act like the NFL before hasn't superseded through the judicial system and said, I don't care what they're going to do in court, this is what's going to happen in the NFL. We haven't even gotten there yet. And that's a problem if you're Antonio Brown. He's already had two workouts since he left New England. And both teams sat there like, we don't know what to do with him because there is no ruling. So in a world where you go after Mike Mayock, who's a general manager, who basically worked for the NFL because he worked for the NFL Network, and then you double down on that and go after Bob Kraft, bro, it doesn't take that much to just suggest that maybe he's not good for the NFL. Let's just say that.
Yeah, Marcellus, I'm going to follow up with you and bring Corona into this. Corona is one of the main reasons why the NFL now has an excuse not to finish their investigation with Antonio Brown. They have other higher priorities than cleaning up Antonio Brown's mess. And then, look, pro sports put up with a lot of BS. But I think the entire world, because of this coronavirus, is going to put up with just a teeny bit less BS. And I think character and what you bring into a locker room is going to just be 2% more important than it was before coronavirus. You have to trust the people you're working with. Eventually, we're going to go back into the TV studio, Marcellus. We have to trust each other that we're not doing stupid behavior and bringing Corona into our workspace. I just think his character is going to catch up with him this offseason. I think there's a chance he misses. Let me get to the money question. The main reason why we have you here, Terrell, is to talk about running backs and running backs getting paid. Christian McCaffrey got paid this offseason in a major way. Derrick Henry got hit with the franchise tag, not a long-term deal. The Tennessee Titans say they're still trying to work out a long-term deal with Derrick Henry, but who deserved to get paid more this offseason? The NFL rushing king, Derrick Henry, or the do-it-all Marshall Faulk of the modern era, Christian McCaffrey?
You see, you threw that deserves to get paid more. You put the more on this thing, and I don't agree with that statement more. Both of these guys need to get paid. And here's the deal, because they have two different style running backs, right? You got McCaffrey, who is not only a really good rusher, but he's also a great receiver out of the backfield. So he fits a different system, and you can use him differently. Where you got, Derrick Henry, you're talking about a physical running back who's only going to fit in a certain amount of schemes that teams are running the ball with. I mean, since Seattle might be running that system right there, he fits well in what they're doing in Tennessee. So you got to look at a player and say what he's worth to you. And for the Tennessee Titans, he is worth a lot. So they should break the bank, make sure that he's taken care of, to make sure they have that running game. Everything they do in Tennessee is off of what this man brings to the table. So it's not about who deserves to get paid more. They both need to get paid. Chris McCaffrey got his money. Derrick Henry needs to get paid. King Henry, get paid. Pay the man.
Look, they both deserve to get paid, but who deserved it more? Christian McCaffrey. He's more versatile, and he has a smaller target area. We all know about big running backs. Shoot, I played running back my entire career until I got to the league. And one thing I witnessed from all the big running backs, TD, I got film too, it's real. All the big running backs I know, when they fall off, they fall off the cliff with a jetpack. I mean, boom, it happens like that. So for Christian McCaffrey, there's an evolution. He could become a pass catcher. Hey, we can move him to slot receiver. Let him be Wes Welker 2.0 or something like that. Kind of how the cornerback goes to safety. There is no shifting Derrick Henry once he hits that wall. it's a wrap. It's going to happen, and it's going to be sudden. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, you got to pay Chris McCaffrey.
Yeah, I've gone back and forth on this. Love them both. Today, and this is where I feel today, I'm going to lean into Derrick Henry. And I say that because again, second and five is a quarterback's best friend. That is how you protect a quarterback. You line him up second and five. We can sit here. Christian McCaffrey's a great receiver, and that's going to be a nice weapon for Teddy Bridgewater. But Derrick Henry is a second and five machine. He's going to get you 4 or 5 yards on first down and put you in great position as a play caller and as a quarterback. And so he carried his team to the playoffs and some playoff upsets. So who deserved it more? I would say Derrick Henry. He made Ryan Tannehill what he is. Yeah. You go look at Christian McCaffrey, Cam Newton, Kyle Allen, all that last year. Great numbers from Christian McCaffrey. And I'm not putting him down. I love the kid. He's a modern-day Marshall Faulk. But I'm going to lean today a bit more into Derrick Henry. TD, he's not quite Derrick Henry. He's not quite Terrell Davis because, yeah, you took the greatest player of all time, John Elway, and elevated him even higher. Derrick Henry hasn't done that quite yet. You're a great analyst for the NFL Network. We'd love to have you back. Love your work. Marcellus, real quick, TD to me kind of looks like Fab Five Freddy from Yo MTV Raps. You remember Fab Five Freddy?
Hell yeah.
Fab Five Freddy.
He does. Look at
that. The 80s background.
Like, oh, hold on. Yeah. I guess, hold on, who's the big guy? It was Dr. Dre. I guess I would be Dr. Dre.
Now we had Dre.
Ed Lover.
And Ed Lover. Yeah, Dr. Dre and Ed Lover.
Lover of Marcella, yeah. Yo, MTV speaks for itself.
yeah, they should do that.
All right, welcome back to Speak for Yourself from the crib. Jason Whitlock, Marcellus Wiley, happy Wednesday. All right, let's roll out to Isaiah Thomas's crib. The former Piston great NBA Hall of Famer, two-time NBA champion, and co-star of the Last Dance documentary, unintended co-star. Isaiah, you have made a comment, though we brought you on today because you made a comment that really irked me, which is unusual for you. But you said that the athletes of today aren't getting the credit that they could and that LeBron and Kevin Durant and these guys would have dominated your era of the NBA. I completely disagree with that, but why do you believe this about LeBron James, and why would he been so dominant in your era?
And both of you being former athletes, we all come to the table, and normally, if all things being even, the bigger, faster, stronger athlete wins. Now, the only way a smaller person has any chance of beating a bigger, stronger, faster athlete is if that bigger, faster, stronger athlete makes a mistake, which gives that smaller player a chance to win. When I look at LeBron James, he and Kevin Durant, if you put both of them in all eras, and if you were to put Kevin Durant on our team with the Pistons, or if you were to put LeBron James on our team with the Pistons, both of those guys would be probably the best players and the best scorers on our team. And when I look at those two guys as being freaks, in the modern day era, and if you put them back in our era, they would have been freaks because of their athleticism. I've never seen two players like a Durant and LeBron James ever in all NBA with the size and the skill set that they both possess.
I wholeheartedly agree with you, Isaiah. Look, the only counter to that conversation really is, well, if the guys of yesterday had all the technology, the mindset, the access, et cetera, the medical resources, things will be different for those guys as well. True. But when we're talking about the physics, bigger, faster, stronger, and then if you look at the volume, the collection of athletes now, I dare someone to look at the talent level of the sixth man back in the 80s versus the sixth man right now in terms of what you're seeing. It's just a different animal, and it's okay. I think only the ego holds on, that thinks that this world is not evolving and sports are not evolving as well. These guys are walking in the gym, jumping out the gym. But back in the day, we heard Jordan Rules and others say, if he just doesn't get in the air, we have a chance. Well, good luck having that as a strategy now, because everybody's in the damn air. So you can just see, looking at yesterday, no slight to greatness, because greatness cuts through era. But the average Joe of yesterday wouldn't even be known today, because there are just too many talented guys.
But, you know, when
my position, Isaiah, would be if Kevin Durant played back in your era, he would play the game differently. He might have a post-up game. He might be the next iteration of Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. If LeBron was played in your era, he might have played the game the way Karl Malone played it, rather than the way the game is played today.
That is absolutely true, and that's where coaching and scheme and system comes in. It's like Michael Jordan is probably the greatest, you know, wing scorer that's ever played the game. And the reason why I say wing scorer, because when we don't count Chamberlain and we don't count Kareem in the conversation. So now I put it in the category, he's the greatest wing scorer ever. He and LeBron James. Now, that being said, if Michael Jordan played in today's era, he would be a different player. He would probably have a coach saying to him he couldn't take the mid-range shot. Michael Jordan would either be dunking or shooting a three-point shot. He'd be great at both of them, but the thing that he's known for in terms of being, you know, probably the greatest mid-range player ever, we wouldn't see that in today's game if he was in this era.
Okay, but also, I think the way y'all competed in that era is completely different than the way guys compete in this era. The competition was more fierce in your era. Do you disagree with that?
I think because of the physicality of the game that was allowed during that era, it definitely makes you a little bit more competitive, and it makes things tougher for you because of the physicality. Resistance is always good. You know, and both of you are, you know, former football players. So, you know, if you put Jerry Rice in today's game, who's going to cover him? They couldn't cover him back then. You put him in today's game where you know, he can run down the field and he can go across the middle. Back when you guys were playing football, you know, very few receivers went across the middle. In basketball, the rules are very similar to football. Everything has changed. So consequently, the statistics have gone up in football, just like the statistics have gone up in individual performances in basketball. But there are a lot of things that you can do now in basketball, just like in football. There are a lot of things that you can do that, you know, 15, 20 years ago, you know, you just couldn't do.
Look, I got a crazy story real quick about exactly what you asked, Jason. Great question. Because things look tougher doesn't mean that they're better. We had a slower receiver in Jacksonville one time in training camp, running, throw the ball, deep route. He dove for it, caught it, the crowd erupted. You know what our coach said? If he was faster, he wouldn't have had to dive. That's my point. That's what we're seeing right now. These guys ain't got to do all that. They are different, brother. It's physics. It's crazy. Sorry.
No, I mean, really, they are different. You know, before I met Steph Curry, I thought Steph Curry and I was the same size. And then when I met him, you know, he's a little bigger than me. You know?
That is true. Hey, Isaiah, thank you so much. We got to keep it moving. Want to have you back when the Last Dance documentary's over, because really want to get into that in depth. All right, Jason Whitlock, Marcellus Wiley on a Wednesday afternoon.